All right, court is back in session. And the next case on the docket is United States of America versus BGG. And Nicole Mariani is here for the appellate, the United States. David Marcus is here for appellee, BGG. And Ms. Mariani, you may begin with your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. I'm Assistant United States Attorney Nicole Mariani, and I'm appearing on behalf of the government. There are two roads upon which this court can travel to resolve this appeal: the district court's limited authority under Rule 48A, or the plain language of the statute of limitations. And both roads lead to reversal of the district court's order dismissing the information with prejudice. On the first road, the district court exceeded its limited authority under Rule 48A when it denied the government's motion without finding the government sought the dismissal in bad faith. The district court's anticipatory analysis of the timeliness of a future indictment was procedurally improper and incorrect. Both the Supreme Court and this court, in cases such as Rinaldi and Mata, have been clear that the authority granted to district courts to deny Rule 48A motions must be narrow to preserve the constitutional separation of powers. To that end, Rule 48A motions can only be denied where the defendant demonstrates a rebuttal of a presumption of good faith that the prosecutor sought the dismissal in bad faith. As the Supreme Court explained in Rinaldi, this analysis is not concerned with the government's reason for bringing the prosecution or its strategy and whether or not it will maintain the prosecution. It is only concerned with the stated reason for dismissal, and bad faith is narrowly defined and very rarely found. Here, the district court did not find that the government's reason for the dismissal, which was that BGG asserted his Fifth Amendment right to prosecution, was made in bad faith. Instead,
Judge Middlebrooks does say that the government sought to obtain a tactical advantage to deny BGG's constitutional rights. That seems to me that's tantamount to a finding of bad faith.
I think you'd be correct if the test was that the government brought the prosecution in bad faith. Here the question is, did the government seek the dismissal in bad faith? And well, of course, we agree with Judge Middlebrook's decision on the merits, sort of that hook is, why did we seek the dismissal under Rule 48A? Why did we seek the dismissal? We sought the dismissal because BGG asserted his Fifth Amendment right to prosecution by indictment. At that point, that's why we sought it, and we sought the dismissal to uphold that Fifth Amendment assertion, and believed based on our legal analysis, which is in line with the majority of the case law and the plain language of the statute of limitations, that we could obtain a timely indictment against BGG. If you think about the reason for the dismissal, this isn't a case where the government could have proceeded on an adjudication, but was trying to defer prosecution.
Could the government have gone to another district and sought the return of an indictment, a district outside of the Southern District of Florida?
That's a point BGG makes in his brief. One thing we would point out with that venue is this was consistent with the way we had in charge all of the instance cases. If you look at the information, all of the charge offense conduct occurred at BGG's office in Palm Beach. That's where he accepted the payments. That's where he was seeing patients. In addition, if you think about this within the broader pragmatic question of the pandemic, you're now asking us to go to another jurisdiction during time when there were travel bans, when there were quarantines, when there were rolling court closures. That didn't really seem to be a pragmatic solution. And again, you know, sort of under Rule 48A and the separation of power, the government has primacy in its charging decisions, including deciding what district to charge a case in.
Could the government have afforded itself of this procedure even in the absence of a suspension of grand juries by the chief judge of the district court? I mean, can the government do this anytime it wants to, if the statute of limitations is running?
Correct. We believe under the clear statutory language and the plain meaning of Section 3282 and 3288, as Congress has written them, that yes, at any time under the plain language of 3282, if the government files an information, that tolls the statute of limitations. And this is sort of moving into that second argument, but if you look at the plain language of Section 3282, it states that the limitations period is told when the information is instituted.
Seems like if the government thought that it had the authority to do that anytime it wants to, that it would not have gone to Congress and asked Congress to extend the statute of limitations If the statutory scheme has already allowed this tactic, and Congress said no, Republicans and Democrats, and there's been a slew of former United States attorneys who agree with that position.
We believe that Congress's passage of the CARES Act is consistent with the government's position. First, I want to note that there's nothing in that largely economic legislation.
But my question is, if you thought you had the authority to do that, why ask Congress to extend the statute of limitations? And then Congress says no.
Why we did that was sort of a belt and suspenders approach. What that proposed legislation indicated was not that we did not believe we could use 3282 in this way. What it indicated was that DOJ was encouraging Congress to provide a clear and simple answer to the tension a grand jury suspension will cause between the statute of limitations and the Fifth Amendment right to prosecution by indictment. Despite, or perhaps due to, the very clear statutory language in Section 3282, very few courts have addressed what does the phrase instituted in information means.
Well, the Supreme Court has interpreted the word institute in Jabin versus the United States. It's a tax case. But the Supreme Court says the filing of a complaint by the tax commissioner does not institute the complaint because it does not effectively begin the criminal process. Now, it involves a complaint, not an information, but why should the rationale be any different with respect to an information?
Yes, Judge Wells, in the case of Jabin versus United States is distinguishable on two fronts. First, in Jabin, the Supreme Court was interpreting a statute of limitations for tax offenses that permitted a 9-month extension where, and this is important, a complaint is instituted before a commissioner of the United States. It added before a commissioner of the United States. That is not present in Section 3282. And if you think about what does before a commissioner of the United States mean and what does a complaint mean? At that time, under the version of Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 4 that was in place, a commissioner could institute a complaint only if he found probable cause first. That was a drafting requirement. So the Supreme Court rejected the argument that filing a complaint in that case under that particular statute without a probable cause determination instituted it because that interpretation removed the role of the commissioner and the statute of limitations specifically referenced the commissioner. So that does not translate into our case, right? Because there's a material difference. Well, both statutes use the verb instituted. The tax statute also included that clause before a commissioner of the United States. Thus, it contained a further directive that's not in Section 3282A. In addition, Jabin's reasoning was tied to the fact that, as you referenced, it involved a complaint. A complaint cannot be created, it cannot be drafted, until a commissioner finds it is supported by probable cause. That is a prerequisite to filing. But in contrast, for informations exist when a prosecutor drafts them. There's no other further hurdle it needs to cross. We are drafted, and then it's filed. That is all sort of the path that an information takes to draft it. And then that filing begins both the criminal proceedings and it confers subject matter jurisdiction on the federal courts. In contrast, the government could not create a complaint that would begin the proceedings or confer federal subject matter jurisdiction without that probable cause determination. So that's why the Supreme Court did define institute in a different way in Jabin, but I don't think it's applicable to our case because we're dealing with a materially different statute of limitations. Which I think sort of loops back into really what we're looking at is what did Congress say? Congress here drafted a very clear, unambiguous statute of limitations. It says the information must be instituted. I was saying, what does instituted mean? Which, as UGG agrees, the term instituted means inaugurated, commenced, or began. It connotes origination and establishment. The object of the verb instituted in Section 3282 is the information. That's all the statute requires, is that the information come into existence or be established within 5 years. Because it's a pleading, and information comes into existence when it's filed with the court. That's when it becomes a legal document. And a filed information is not a legal nullity. Not only does it initiate the criminal charges, but it confers subject matter jurisdiction on the federal courts because it alleges an offense against the United States. After the Supreme Court's 2002 case in Cotton, that is all that is required to confer federal subject matter jurisdiction. In addition, a filed information permits the defendant to begin filing responsive pleadings. There's no suggestion in 3282 of any further requirements. And that statutory language is really the beginning and the end of our analysis. You know, to counter that clear statutory text, EGG points to Rule 7B, which is a claim processing rule that outlines the procedure for a defendant to waive his Fifth Amendment right.
So you would agree then, counsel, that our standard of review is whether or not Judge Middlebrooks, and I know his interpretation of the statute of this rule disagrees with that of Judge Altman, but you would agree that we're bound by an abuse of discretion standard of review in this case?
Yes, because we are within the denial of a Rule 48A motion that applies. But again, within abuse of discretion, if someone makes an error of law, that is still per se abuse of discretion if there's an error of law.
Okay. All right.
All right, if the court has no further questions, the government will reserve the rest of its time for rebuttal.
All right, we'll hear from the appellee, Mr. Marcus.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is David Marcus and I represent BGG. It's nice to see everybody. I'd like to start with the Jabin case because I think that's the controlling case here. And it obviously comes from the Supreme Court. Jabin talks about what instituted means. And it does so in another statute of limitations statute and context. So the Supreme Court in that case determined that a case was not instituted for tolling the statute of limitations just by filing a complaint. And the Supreme Court makes a difference between institute and filing. So the government in Jabin argued the same thing that it's arguing in this case, that the mere filing of the complaint operated to give them a 9-month grace period under the statute. And the government said, listen, in Jabin, we didn't need to comply with all the other federal rules of criminal procedure as long as we filed it and then dismissed it. And what does the Supreme Court say? It says, no way. It says, the government's position, quote, provides no safeguard whatever to prevent the government from filing a complaint at a time when it does not have its case made and then using the 9-month period to make it. The court interpreted the word institute to require the complaint be, quote, adequate to begin effectively the criminal process prescribed by the federal criminal rules. So does the filing of the information here, is it adequate to begin effectively the criminal process prescribed by the federal criminal rules? Clearly not. And the government admits that it knew that when it filed it, that there was not going to be a waiver under Rule 7. And so how did we get off on this wrong track and not following Jabin in this case? What happened was the Seventh Circuit a long time ago came out with a contrary decision and didn't discuss or engage Jabin. It dropped it in a footnote and said, because it's a different statute, it doesn't apply. And so then all these other cases sort of followed suit and we got off on the wrong track. Judge Middlebrooks rightly said, listen, we have to see what institute means under both the plain meaning of the words and what the Supreme Court says and the legislative history. By the way, I know in a lot of the arguments this week and this morning, we've been talking about the Garner text, Garner and Scalia. Garner and Scalia talk about when the Supreme Court defines a word, unless there's a contrary indication in the statute, we should go with that definition. And the Supreme Court in Jabin defined institute as not merely filed. It has to comply with the federal criminal rules. And everybody agrees that it did not do so. I mean, under the government's reading, a secretary could file it before the court without any supervision because that operates to start it. Or if an indictment doesn't go before the grand jury and some secretary types indictment on the top of a piece of paper and files it, that would somehow be instituted or filed. That's not enough under the statute. We must comply with the rules and the Fifth and Sixth Amendment obviously apply. And that's why Judge Wilson, you were right when you pointed out DOJ going to Congress. Obviously, DOJ went to Congress because they were concerned that they didn't have enough time under the statute with the pandemic. And so they asked for a year and it was rejected. It wasn't just rejected by a slim majority of Democrats or liberals. It was rejected overwhelmingly by both sides. Mike Lee said, over my dead body. It's pretty rare, especially today, to see both sides of the aisle come forward and say, we're not doing something. We agree and speak in a unified front. Speaking of unified, it wasn't just, it's not just criminal defense lawyers who are on the side of BGG here. We have the Cato Institute, former prosecutors, NACDL. It's very rare to see this group of amici come together and support a criminal defendant, which it has done so here. I'd like to move also to the point, Judge Wilson, that you asked the government about the only way it could have proceeded in this case. It is not true that the only way, as the government says in its brief, it could have proceeded was by a grand jury indictment in Miami or in South Florida, excuse me. There were 9 other districts where venue was available, including the Middle District. And in CIS cases, this was a big group of these cases that have been brought across the country in different districts and had been brought within the 5 years without a problem. What happened here is the case went through 3 different prosecutors. They waited to the last minute and then they couldn't bring it, but they couldn't bring it in the Southern District, but they could have brought it in a number of other districts where there were grand juries sitting. I think also we should look at what the government's reading of this statute means. It means, first of all, like Judge Wilson, you pointed out, this isn't just in a time of a pandemic. At any time the government wants, it can just basically say, we give ourselves a 6-month extension, even if the information is invalid, even if it doesn't follow the rules. We can give ourselves a 6-month extension. It's also true that their reading would mean that the information is valid under some rules, but not invalid under others, which—
I just want to confirm the 6-month extension only applies when the statute of limitation passes, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Right. Correct. And what they did here, just so
you— I mean, it's not like you're adding 6 months to the speedy. That's not, this is a different situation. This is 6 months added because they file an information, they dismiss it, and the statute of limitation expires, and then they dismiss. You could dismiss the next day.
Correct. And you know, if you look at what they did here, I mean, it raises eyebrows. They charged by information, knowing that there was no waiver a few days before the statute runs, doesn't let the defense know until the day the statute runs. So we can't inform the court about our position until it's too late.
Thank
you, Judge Wilson. With regards to Rule 48, how do you address the argument about separation of powers that the executive has the prerogative to dismiss an indictment or an information or a complaint at its prerogative, and that it's not for the district court to deny a dismissal?
Sure. And to me, this is the easiest of the points for the defense, because Rule 48 says with leave of court. And so everybody agrees that the government has to go to the court and get leave to dismiss. And everybody agreed that this case should be dismissed, Judge Lagoa. The question is, should it be dismissed with or without prejudice? And the 11th Circuit and every court has said that bad faith on behalf of the government doesn't mean like some subjective evil motive. It means a tactical advantage. And it was pretty striking, I think, that the government conceded just now that if we were talking about filing the information, they can see that that is tactical, that would be brought under Rule 48A, that the filing itself, they're saying the dismissal wasn't tactical, but it's the same thing. They dismissed it so that they could qualify under this, so that they could refile and file it at a time more convenient for them and where there was a grand jury. That is the whole point of Dial, which said that in order to receive a tactical advantage and derogation of the defendant's rights, same with Rinaldi, where they said it's file, dismiss, refile is what bad faith means. And if we don't, if we're gonna require cases to be filed, dismissed, and refiled before we can brought it, it's really gonna undercut the purpose of A, the statute of limitations, which is to give a clear stopping point for a case. It's also going to require defendants to spend an awful lot more money litigating the case. And if a district judge like Judge Middlebrooks' colleague, Judge Altman, denies it, you can't get to this court until you go all the way to trial and lose. So this is why it's much better for it to be raised as it was in this procedural posture under Rule 48 And as Judge Wilson pointed out, it's an abuse of discretion standard.
Well, let me ask you about that. Could we say that Judge Middlebrooks abused his discretion by failing to give persuasive authority to the Seventh Circuit's decision in verdict, Dana?
No, Your Honor, because what Judge Middlebrooks did, of course, the Seventh Circuit opinion was not binding. The Jabin court is binding. And the words of the statute are binding. So what Judge Middlebrooks said is, I'm following Jabin, I'm following the words of the statute, I'm following the legislative history. And I also, Judge Middlebrooks said, find that it was done for a tactical reason, as you pointed out. He made that explicit finding under Rule 48A, which that factual—
He didn't use the magic words, though. He didn't use the words bad faith.
No, but he used the words tactical, Your Honor. And that's that this court in Dial said bad faith is a tactical is tactical reason. It doesn't mean subjective bad motives. So this court has already found, as every court, Rinaldi in the Supreme Court, every court has found that bad faith means a tactical reason. And the government has admitted that this was a tactical reason so that it could rebring the case. That's a By the way, that's what the
what case, Mr. Marcus, can you stand for that proposition that tactical means bad faith?
Sure. It's a Dial from the Supreme Court, which is 868 F second 424, a 1989 case. And I'll just quote it, that dismissal can be with prejudice if the government seeks dismissal, quote, in order to achieve a tactical advantage. There's other cases, the Pitts case, which we've cited in our brief from the DC District Court. The Rinaldi case from the Supreme Court says that the whole point of Rule 48 is to stop a harassment of a defendant where there's a case brought, dismissed for a tactical advantage, and then rebrought. And one of the examples that's used, Judge Lagoa, in the cases is, you know, if we get to a jury and the government sees the jury and doesn't like it and just dismisses it and rebrings the case for at a later time, they weren't doing it for an evil subjective intent. They were doing it for a tactical advantage. They didn't like how the jury looked. So they dismiss and rebring the case. Here, they dismiss because they knew we wouldn't waive the information. They knew their information was invalid and they wanted to bring it at a time later, clearly for tactical reasons. A couple last points that I think are important. I know it's not great to talk about legislative history these days, but the legislative history clearly supports us. The government doesn't even take issue with it in their brief. They don't take us on that. And for good reason, because in 1964, when 3288 was amended to include informations, the Senate report says the amendments would therefore permit re-indictment in similar cases where an information was filed after the defendant waived an open court prosecution by indictment. I mean, it could not be clear. So if the words are ambiguous, which I really don't think they are, we can look to the legislative history for support. By the way, just to talk about the words for one second, you know, the prosecutor and I agree that institute sort of means in one sense to start, right? To start something. So I've been trying to think of an analogy about starting. And, you know, I thought about the Olympics where we're watching a race begin and all the runners are at the blocks. And there's the starter guy with the little starter pistol who shoots, you know, to start everybody for running. If a racer jumps the gun, we call that a false start, right? It doesn't institute the race. The race has not begun if the runner jumps the gun. Here, the prosecutor jumped the gun. There was no consent to the information. There was no waiver. It was a false start. The prosecutor admitted that. A false start does not institute anything. This information didn't count for anything. And so we can't use it to institute anything. I know my time's running up and I've been saying a lot and speaking fast. So I just want to make sure I don't forget anything here. And to sum up and finish up, the words are clear. Congress didn't say file. The Supreme Court is clear that institute does not mean file. It has said so. This court should follow Jabin and the 11th and the Supreme Court. The legislative history is clear. And finally, the maxim that statute of limitations should be read in favor of repose, in favor of cases being quiet, that's clear here. So for all of those reasons, because Judge Middlebrooks had the authority under Rule 48 with leave of court to say, I'm doing it with prejudice because this was tactical and he did use those magic words and he did make those findings, we shouldn't make defendants go all the way to an indictment and to trial when this case is clear. There's a lot of other cases pending watching this one. And so we shouldn't make all the litigation wait until the end of a trial or end of litigation. We have this case, it's teed up now, it's ready, and the case should be affirmed. Thank you for listening.
All right, thank you, Mr. Marcus. Ms. Mariani, you've reserved some time for a rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honors. First, I just wanna say the government has not conceded anything was tactical. Our argument is that to the extent we're gonna go to the underlying merits dealing with the statute of limitations, we are making use of congressionally authorized procedures within the statute of limitations in section 3282 and 3288. And speaking of section 32-
That was a finding by the, I mean, you're not conceding it, but the district court did find that it was done as a in order to obtain a tactical advantage and to deny BGG his constitutional right to be charged within the statute of limitations by a grand jury. I mean, that's a finding that was made by the district court.
Yes, the district court did use that phrase. We disagree with it clearly.
This is a criminal case. I mean, it's not a clearly erroneous finding. And the district judges have deference to make those sorts of findings, right?
Yes, judges do make deference. Our argument would be to the extent it's premised on an error of law, which is a misunderstanding of the plain meaning of the statute of limitations in 3282 and 3288 and what Congress has expressly stated the government may do in its charging documents, then yes, it would be a clear error to make that finding if it's premised on an underlying error of law. Speaking of 3288, my opposing counsel had mentioned the legislative history of that statute. He was referring to the legislative history in 1964. The curious thing about that statute, it was again amended in 1988. In 1988, Congress, in the 1964 version, it said that Section 3288 Savings Clause applied to an information that was filed after the defendant waives an open court prosecution by indictment. In 1988, Congress removed that phrase after the defendant waives an open court prosecution by indictment. In the Senate report accompanying that 1988 amendment, which is the official legislative history as opposed to, say, tweets that have appeared on the internet, it explains that the defendant no longer has to first waive an open court prosecution by indictment for the savings clause to apply to a dismissed information. Because Section 3288 should encompass the dismissal of an information for any reason that would not bar further prosecution. We've also been talking a little bit about the word filed versus the word instituted. And I think Section 3288 sheds some light on that. Section 3288, which provides a savings clause for charges that are dismissed after the limitations period expires, explains that the second brief limitations period applies to charges that were filed within the limitations period, but then were dismissed after the limitations period for any reason except where the reason for dismissal was the failure to file an indictment or information within the limitations period or some other reason that would bar dismissal. That verb choice, filed, to describe an act that renders both an indictment or an information timely indicates that Congress intended for the terms instituted and filed to be synonymous. That Congress used instituted in 1382, which was passed in 1790, and then the word filed in section 3288, which was written in 1948, to describe that same moment when the statute of limitations is told, is logical. In section 1382, Congress, at a time when American criminal procedure was being developed, specified an indictment tolls the statute of limitations when it is found, and an information tolls the statute of limitations when it is instituted. Those different verbs denote the different paths those two charging documents need to take in drafting. Specifically, a list of allegations written by a prosecutor does not become an indictment until it is found by that grand jury. But a list of allegations written by a prosecutor becomes an information that can be filed once it's written by the prosecutor. So the use of those two different verbs, found and instituted, confirmed that an indictment and an information still had to adhere to their different drafting requirements. Now we get to section 3288, which was began using that word filed in 1948. Congress would no longer need to be so concerned about those drafting requirements. This is because the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure were passed in 1946. Those laid out how an indictment and an information work. In addition, the applicability of this 3288 savings clause hinges on whether the charging document told the statute of limitations. In that context, the word filed could be used to cover both an indictment and an information, because it's that final step of filing that tolls the limitation period, and there was no need to be redundant that was already specified in section 3282.
Judge Wilson, may I ask one more question?
Absolutely.
Counsel, in the Dial case that Mr. Marcus referred to, this court went through the requirements of Rule 48A.
Yes.
And there, I think it was Judge Kravitch specifically said, the parties agree that the question whether Rule 48A requires a government to contemporaneously state its reasons for seeking the dismissal. Can you tell me what does the record show was the reason for the government seeking the dismissal under the Rule 48 motion? What did you articulate to Judge Middlebrooks?
I believe what I was articulated to Judge Middlebrooks was that we were seeking the dismissal because BGG had chosen to invoke his Fifth Amendment right, or conversely, he had declined to waive prosecution by indictment. And because he had declined to waive prosecution by indictment, we could no longer proceed on the information, which is correct under Rule 7. Within the context of explaining that argument, the prosecution did go on and explain why it had done things the way it had, which was that it believed it could file the information, thus instituting the information and tolling the statute of limitations, and that it then planned.
How could you believe that you could file the information when Rule 7 says that, because this is a felony, correct? This is a felony case. This is it's never been a misdemeanor case, correct?
No, right. Correct.
So under what belief did the government have that Rule 7 did not require for a conference or some representation or written statement or letter sent to Mr. Marcus, who was representing the defendant, asking whether or not he would waive the indictment?
There's nothing of that sort required in the text of Rule 7B. There's nothing in Rule 7B that prohibits the filing of an information without a prosecution waiver, or that says an information cannot be filed without a waiver of prosecution. And indeed, if you look through the procedure of Rule 7B, which requires notifying the defendant of the charges and the information in open court and then accepting his waiver, it sort of presupposes that the information does already exist.
So what did the government tell Judge Middlebrooks with regard to why it could not file or take this case to the grand jury before the suspension of the grand jury because of the pandemic? Because this was really just done at the last minute. What was the reason? I mean, the government had plenty of time to take the case to the grand jury before the Judge Moore's order, right?
We've heard the grand jury was suspended on, I believe, March 26th, 2020. This information was filed at the end of August 2020, which was after, I believe,
right, but
four.
This is not a reactive case. This is an investigative case. And when did the government have or commence its investigation?
Unfortunately, that's when, not in the record.
Okay.
I honestly have to be candid with the court. I'm not sure. That's not on our record in appeal when the investigation began. But I can tell you that when the grand jury suspension occurred, we still had over 5 months remaining on the five-year statute of limitations under 3282. At the time it occurred, the COVID pandemic was, at least for myself and I think most people, entirely unexpected. That first grand jury suspension that Judge Moore issued was only 30 days. He then continued to issue rolling 30-day orders every 30 days. We, quite frankly, were hoping grand juries would come back. We would be able to indict this case.
But by the time, when did the statute of limitations run? It was in August, correct?
I believe it was August 31st.
Right. In August, hadn't the grand juries commenced by then?
No, they did not resume until November 17th.
Until November, okay. In the Southern District of Florida.
In the Southern District of Florida, they did not resume until November 17th. And at that time, they were only doing two grand jury sittings a week, which is a very small fraction of how many you usually have. If the court has no further questions, the government will rest on its brief and request that the district court's order be reversed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mariani and Mr. Marcus.
Thank you all. Thank you both.
Thank you. Nice seeing everybody. Have a nice weekend.
You too.
And that completes our docket for this week, and the court is adjourned.